today on Vox Talks Economics. From the CEPR Annual Symposium 2025, three exciting pieces of new research from new economists. Welcome to another of our special episodes recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. It is a law of Vox Talks Economics that when we visit a symposium or a conference, we try to find the most interesting new research from economists who are just starting out in their careers. And so in Paris recently, we invited three of them to the CEPR office to tell us about their work. We spoke to Elishuma Philip of the University of Zurich about slum redevelopment, Ali Bakhtawar of the Aix-Marseille School of Economics about lawfare in Pakistan. But first, Lucy Giorgi, also from Aix-Marseille, whose research tracks the impact of sex segregation in French elementary schools, which, as you'll hear, happened more recently than you might imagine. Lucy, hang on. Elementary schools education was single sex in France until 1957.
Yeah, that's very surprising. I was the first one surprised when I looked at those numbers. So before the late 1950s, there was a boys' school and girls' schools. And when they allowed to have co-educational schools, they did not do it at the same time. They allowed that. And then for 20 years, there was a change until the date that we know in France, which is 1975. So when you look about co-educational school in France, you only know that it's starting in 1975. You don't know about the 1957 date. And before that, some schools, the rural schools, were allowed to have co-educational schools if it was only one classroom. But even if they were in the same classroom, they were separated in the playgrounds and were not playing together. So it was really this thing about having boys of one side and girls on the other side.
The law changed, did it, in 57 to start that process of co-education?
Yes.
What did you want to find out about this?
So I was interested about what was happening when you put two groups that were not used to interact together. Does it have impacts? And I wanted to look at the long-term impacts, which were labor market outcomes. So do you earn more in your adult life when you are put together when you are a child?
So if you're looking at something like the later impact of schooling on how people work, the jobs they do, how they get on, you're dealing with a set of people who are working and a set of people who are being at school. How do you match those two things together?
That was also one struggle about this, was to find data about the schools.
Yeah.
Because it was not that long ago, but still too long ago to have something that was already...
1957.
Yeah.
They didn't keep computer records.
Exactly. So you had to go to the archives and dig for the numbers, which I found at the departmental level for each year. So what I know about those students, I know in which year they are born, I know in at what year they were at school, and in that department, what was the share of co-educational schools or not. And then I have my administrative data, where I have individual data. And for those people, I also know where they were born and when they were born.
Ah.
So I match them with their year of birth and department of birth to know what was the share of co-educational classroom that they could have experienced at the time of birth.
Okay. And because the schools were integrated bit by bit, you can discover some kind of causal effect here.
Yeah, that was the idea. So what is very interesting about this reform is that because it did not happen all at the same time, mm-hmm. some departments implemented it, but not right away all the time. It was it's always varying by some percentage. Let's say you don't go from 0 to 100% mm-hmm. for one department. So a variation across cohorts in one department, but also across departments for cohorts.
So what did you discover here about the effect of co-education on the earnings, the later earnings of women and men when they were working?
When you're exposed to co-education, there is a decrease in the gender wage gap, about one third, which comes from both an increase in the women's earnings, but also a decrease in the men's earnings. So there is this theory of the mediocre men, so men that were not fit for one position, that have been replaced by women that are better than them, because now there is more competition for them to have a job, and women, they can have the position that they were supposed to be in, what I could not exceed before.
So what is changing here? Are the women getting more qualifications? Are they making different choices? Are they going into different jobs? What's going on?
So it's more an idea about aspirations. So what I found in the end is that women or men, they don't have more education. It just changes the type of jobs women are doing. What I found is that women are doing more jobs that have higher median earnings. So they change the type of jobs that they were doing. And I don't find anything for the men.
I was thinking about this, and I was wondering if there is another effect here, that schools that embraced co-education early might be in places that were more progressive anyway, and so therefore the women that went to school in those places might also have this effect independently of whether they were co-educated or not. Is that potentially something that could confound your results?
Yeah, that's a big concern, but I would say that it's not really the case. For two things, is that the model I'm using, I observe the differences in between departments, so that if I find something, it should not come from being in one department instead of another. And I also do another kind of test where I look at departments that were always the highest in the co-educational share compared to the one that were always the lowest. And I don't find any differences before the reform. So they have always the same no effects before the reform. And I find no effect after the reform. I only see differences about those two type of departments when there is this change in implementation.
As you say, this is now a historical policy change. It was all over by the 1970s. But there are still some parents, I know some parents, who choose to send their daughters to single-sex schools. If you could talk to them, what would your advice to them be?
My advice is that it's always better to be integrated. And this thing about the single-sex schools is most of the time, it's always, there is a selection in before. So it's families that are caring about their daughter or their sons that want the best for them, so they will put them in those single-sex schools, which might be better because it's always this subset of individuals that are selected before. So I would not say that those girls that would succeed better in single-sex school would not have succeeded as much good in a co-educational school. I would say for me, it's always better to see the real world at school than discovering later on the fact that you have to compete with men, that you need to also know how to talk to those men. I think it's good to learn that very early on.
Thank you very much. Ali, what would you like to ask Lucy?
Hey, Lucy, super interesting paper. So I was wondering that what was the motivation for the government to bring this change? Why would they consider it?
When they first allowed co-educational schools, they said in the text they did not do it for principals. They did it only because they had school constraints. So there was the baby boom. And they didn't want to build new schools, so they just said, okay, where there is those capacity constraints, let's have boys and girls together.
So it wasn't about trying to change the norms or anything, so it was just about the capacity constraints that they had.
Yeah.
That is quite surprising as well, isn't it? Ali Shuba, what do you think?
I was thinking about this, if you could say something about whether it's that the teacher inputs changed or is it just because of interactions with the girls and the boys together? Because I was thinking that what if previously it was the case that they gave the best teachers to the men and now that it's mixed and so the better teacher input is what's driving this?
It's something that I cannot really know. One thing that I know is that in boys' schools, it was also women's teacher. So it was not only the men that were teaching the boys and the women that were teaching the girls. About the gender, there is no effect. About the quality of the teacher, I would say that in France, we don't really select the teachers that are in one school. If you are the oldest, you are assigned to one school if you want that school. But there is not the director of the school choosing the teachers. So overall, I would not think that there is a change in quality when you merge the schools, but it's something that I cannot really for sure.
Yeah, I was thinking about this because of Tim's question about co-educational schools, because parents who send kids to single gender schools, these are schools that are super competitive and super high quality, typically in the UK, for instance, right?
So yeah, it's sort of fascinating to find out how things were done not that long ago here, where we are now in Paris. Thank you very much, Lucy.
Thank you.
Ellie Schubert, for your research, it's a very different situation. Mm-hmm. We're talking about slum redevelopment. Tell me about what we mean by a slum and how common slums are in our major cities still.
Slums are extremely common in cities in developing countries. So half of the population in cities in developing countries live in these neighborhoods. And broadly, these are neighborhoods that feature extremely poor living conditions and often have insecure tenure because they are often illegal. And the UN, for instance, defines slums as neighborhoods that are dense, overcrowded, unsanitary, and dilapidated with little to no tenure security. But you should not think of slums as only a feature of cities in a third world country, let's say.
No.
So in Paris, for instance, where we are today, before the 1850s, before the Haussmannian reconstruction, quite a lot of the city center in Paris also consisted of neighborhoods that look very similar to the slums in Mumbai today.
You're talking about redeveloping these slums, which by the way you've defined them, seems obviously like a good idea. And we assume in general that it's good for the people who live in slums. Can we naturally just assume that?
I would say no. So, of course, we have research showing that these redevelopments do benefit the neighborhood.
Yeah.
But I think you should assume that they are not necessarily good for the residents, even though we didn't have a lot of evidence about this until now. And this is basically because it's hard to track them. Most of the time, these residents were evicted without any compensation. They're out of a house and they're evicted the same time as the neighbors. So don't even have another person in their social network they could go to for a roof over their head. And typically, they also worked in their slums. So they're also out of a job simultaneously. Governments compensate residents. Then the question is, were these compensations large enough to compensate for these costs that they had to bear because of evictions?
And this is the sort of question that you're investigating for the slums in Mumbai. So first of all, tell me about the slums in Mumbai and the lives of people who live there.
In Mumbai, like in many megacities in the world, more than 42% of its residents live in slums. And it's a city of 12 million, so quite a lot of
people. That's a lot of people,
yeah.
Yes.
These neighborhoods, they have extremely poor living conditions. So I can see the housing quality and, you know, how wealthy these residents are and so on in my data. And I see that the quality of the housing is very poor. They have very poor access to clean water and sanitation. They also extremely poor. And also what I don't see in the administrative data that I have, but in small sample surveys, is that these residents typically work very close to where they live. Many of them have their businesses within the slum.
So what was the policy to redevelop these slums?
In Mumbai, the policy was implemented in kind of a unique manner. So in 1995, the Slum Rehabilitation Act gave residents who were living in the slum already at the time of policy announcement the right to own an apartment in their redeveloped slum. So the compensation is pretty generous. They get an apartment when their slum is redeveloped, right?
Yeah.
The ones who arrived later were evicted without compensation. Even though the policy was announced in 1995, redevelopments have been happening anytime between then and now, making some people eligible within the slums and some people not.
You're tracking what happens to those residents who are displaced. I suppose it's the same question I was asking Lucy. How do you manage to track those residents? You've got an equally difficult but different problem.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest challenges for this project. So first, what helped me was that the Slum Rehabilitation Authority does a slum survey before the slum is approved for redevelopment. So I did have this data on who lives in that particular slum that they're considering for redevelopment. Now the question is, how do I track these people over several years to find out what happened to them? My solution was to use the electoral rolls. And the good thing about the electoral rolls in India is that every 5 years before the main elections, the government does an elaborate house listing exercise where they go to each house and get the list of residents who live there. Then I have the list of residents who live in each neighborhood, and I digitized these electoral roll records for the entire city for 15 years. I match residents based on the identifying information in the electoral roll, so their full name, their father's name, their age, and their gender. And this way I can track each of these 12 million residents in the city as they're moving across neighborhoods in the city over 15 years.
So the big question is, when the slums are redeveloped, do the residents successfully leave behind slum living?
This is the big question that I was also interested in. And the short answer is no.
Oh.
So what I first look at is whether they're permanently displaced, right? Because if you get the compensation of an apartment in the redeveloped slum, you have a formal asset already that you can occupy. And this should also make you richer, even if you don't occupy that particular asset itself. So that should help already. So what I see at approval is that quite a lot of people are leaving the slum never to return again. And even their probability of living in this apartment in the redeveloped slum is only kind of 0.2%, so super small. And what I instead find is that they're four times as likely to move to slum neighborhoods near their original slum than they are to live in any formal neighborhood anywhere in the city. So they do not live behind slum living. On average, the policy is only able to get 6% of people out of slums. So for a policy with such a generous compensation, 94% of residents who are getting this compensation are still in slums.
That is a huge failure for a well-intentioned policy. Why are people not leaving that slum life behind?
First, about implementation, what I find is that, worryingly, in 40% of the cases, the residents are evicted, so the slum is cleared, but the compensation never comes because the redevelopment is never completed. So the residents are evicted and you never get this compensation. In a third of the cases, both happen. But even when both these events happen, both clearance and redevelopment, the average construction project takes around 6 years. And I see that all transitions out of slum living are driven by residents in slums, which take less than 4 years. So you can imagine that these are residents who are potentially credit constrained because it's a vulnerable group of population, and they're not able to transfer resources from a good and uncertain state in the future to today just because they don't have the resources to be able to, you know, maintain the standard of living during this process, right?
Okay, so I'm going to make you policymaker about this because this is the sort of policy that could have a huge beneficial effect, but what do we need to do differently to make it work better?
That's a good question and a hard question. What seems to matter a lot is this lag between eviction and compensation, and here the compensation is an apartment in the redeveloped slum. And this is something that's promoted a lot by international organizations because of its ability to give slum residents a home to live in the same place that they wanted to live in originally. What we do know from other programs in cities like Addis Ababa, which is much smaller, is that what works better is sending slum residents to suburbs because the suburbs are quite close by. This is not the case for big megacities like India, where the suburbs where you do have empty land to build is located quite far away. Hence the appeal of this policy. But what is hard about this policy is that there is a natural lag in compensation during development. And it's also not the case that if the government develops it, it's any better, because we do have evidence from sub-Saharan Africa showing that government public work completion rates are also very similar, around 35%. So it's not that this is the problem that goes away if you get the government involved. A mix of a cash compensation immediately that the government ensures that the residents get, followed by a compensation in the future, or a big cash drop immediately, I wonder if that could be a better policy. But of course, more research needs to be done on this.
When you started this project, was the result that you have something that you expected?
I did not expect this at all, that only 0.2% lived in these neighborhoods. I mean, my main plan was to contrast the residents with compensation and how those effects looked like for residents without compensation. My idea was that, of course, with this compensation, things are going to be a bit better, maybe not all the way up to 100%, but maybe 40%. But these numbers were very shocking to me as well.
It's a very fascinating project that millions of people are actually being affected by it. When this redevelopment is successful, do you find anything on the health outcomes or any other development outcomes for people?
The short answer is not at the moment. But I just got access to some health records data from the municipality of Mumbai. And what's great about the death records data is that then I can indeed look at the ultimate health outcome, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. mortality, right? And then say something about how that affects residents and measure the costs of evictions in some way using that. So that's definitely part of the plan.
Thank you very much, Elishuba. I will come back to you when you are that policymaker. Ali, your research is about lawfare. So first of all, can you describe to me what lawfare is and how would I use it if I was a politician?
Lawfare is a combination of the word law and judiciary and warfare. It is using courts as a weapon to target their political rivals. Politicians usually like to use this tool to target their political rivals because once they are in power, they have a lot of incentive for trying to suppress their opposition or suppress other politicians so that they could actually continue to hold on to power.
But politicians have to be accountable. Is it always an abuse of power?
Well, yeah, that's the most important part of it, right? Because legal action against a political rival, on one hand, could be just even-handed or uniform enforcement of law for some wrongdoing. But on the other hand, legal action against a political rival could be selective enforcement of law to target them.
And what did you want to find out about this and how it is used in Pakistan?
I'm studying Pakistan because it gives us the breadth and the scope to study lawfare at scale.
Uh-huh.
So the main question here is, detecting lawfare is not straightforward. There are several issues, for example, data availability. But more importantly, there is a conceptual problem. We need to figure out a way to have politicians who are ex-ante similar in their propensity for yes. wrongdoing. But one politician is lawfared because they're against the government in power and the other politician is let go. In Pakistan, I find robust statistical evidence for this existence and I find large effects. The magnitudes are substantial. Opposition politicians are 70% more likely to be charged and convicted for corruption compared to the base.
That is a huge effect. But tell me about how you find it. What events are you using? What data are you using? Or what period in Pakistan are we referring to?
The data that I have is from 1996 to 2018. And the idea behind this is that we need to figure out a strategy of how we can detect lawfare. There was an establishment of this corruption watchdog in 1999. Unfortunately, we have data from 1996.
To find that causal relationship, because legal cases aren't assigned at random to random people, how do you get around that?
There are several things. It's not only one problem, right? So there are several problems with this.
Yes.
So first of all, my identification hones in on politicians who are already facing corruption investigations. And I use a close election regression discontinuity design, which is comparing marginal election winners with marginal election losers. Why do I use marginal election winners and marginal election losers? Is because on average, these politicians are so similar that one could argue that these politicians would be same. For instance, you know, they win or lose the election just because you are going to vote and you had a flat tire, so you decided, yeah, today I'm not going to vote them. And by these margin of few votes, two, three there, they actually win the election or they lose the election. So the idea is that these politicians are just so similar that they win or lose by a close, close margin. I'm saying that these politicians are similar. So what it allows me to do is test that if their wrongdoing is also similar, that these politicians are ex ante similar in their propensity for wrongdoing before the election. And the focus on looking at the subsample of politicians who have already a corruption investigation against them allows me to circumvent the problem of strategic case filing after the election or their exposed changes in behavior. For example, once a politician gets into office, they might want to start doing more corruption and they would have access to more corruption. So I'm looking at the cases before they came into power. These two margins allows me to differentiate even-handed enforcement of law versus selective targeting.
Now, clearly, it's very bad if you are an individual who has lawfare used against you.
Mm-hmm.
Can we detect an advantage for a government in using it?
Absolutely. There are huge consequences for engaging in lawfare, and the government in power has a lot of advantage when they do it. What I note in the data is that engaging in lawfare allows the government in power to kill something called an incumbency advantage. What is an incumbency advantage? Incumbency advantage, every politician has that in many countries, that once they win an election, because they are in power, they are able to showcase results, the probability for winning the next election in the same location increases.
Uh-huh.
What the government in power does is that by removing them from office, they are essentially eliminating people from having that incumbency advantage. Politicians who are targeted or lawfared entirely lose their incumbency advantage. They are no longer in office. And the other thing is that they are convicted for corruption, and hence their voter base also thinks about, hey, is this guy really corrupt?
Now, it's precisely this problem why we think about the separation of powers and an independent judiciary. Could judges not eliminate lawfare by identifying it?
Absolutely. Why would judges play this dirty game of politicians? Why would judges?
Well, yes.
To understand that, we need to look at how these judges are appointed. These are specialized courts, these anti-corruption courts, and these judges are appointed directly by the prime minister and the president. So originally, these judges are lower court judges, and they are selected from that pool and appointed to these specialized courts. These judges essentially get a promotion, and these judges have a fixed term of 3 years. And after those 3 years, they have to report back to the executive, and the executive decides if they're going to be promoted or terminated. I would argue that these judges have a very strong incentives to play this game. What I also find in the data is that the government repays them. If a judge prosecutes and convicts more of the opposition politicians, their probability to be promoted also increases. So government is also repaying them for their services.
You couldn't think of a system better designed to encourage lawfare, could you? Now, your data ends in 2018. Has the system changed? Have things improved?
Something incredible happened in 2010 in Pakistan. This ability for the executive or the president or the prime minister was taken away. The appointment of judges was taken away from the executive and given to a committee of senior judges. So it was their peer judges, a committee which was then going to appoint judges moving forward from 2010. And what I note is that conditional on the cases being decided by these newly appointed judges in 2013, the effects of this weaponization or effect of this lawfare mitigates essentially post-2013. So my data ends in 2018, and we need more data to continue understanding what happens after that. But I have the data in 2018. There was another election which I have not included in my paper. What I can say is that from 2013 onwards, when the judiciary became more independent, there is a higher probability that this would continue to be better.
Pakistan is a place that we associate with political interference in the legal process, but it's certainly not the only place. What's the policy lesson that you can draw from your research if we want to reduce or get rid of lawfare?
The policy implication is straightforward. If we make the judges more independent, we can disarm courts as a tool that could be used for political repression and targeting. So the main idea is that importance of independence of judiciary. So as long as judiciary is independent, we can shield ourselves from these prosecutions.
This particular kind of judicial appointment system doesn't seem to be a good idea overall, and you do find that this is bad for lawfare. Is it common in other developing countries? What should we learn for the rest of the world?
Yes, this is one of the key things that are the outcomes of this paper, is that the importance of independence of judiciary. And if we look around the world, around 60% of the countries still use presidentially appointed judges. We could look at the examples of Israel. We can look at examples of the US and many other, even not only in developing countries, but also in developed countries. We find that judges are still appointed. Either they're elected or they're appointed by the president. So there is a long way to go, but many countries, including the UK and India, has moved away from it. And they have also similar judicial commissions that appoint these judges.
I was wondering if you had any women in your sample and if you observe gender differences.
Well, unfortunately, in a country like Pakistan, women have been included in the judiciary only recently. In my subsample, only 4% of the judges are women. We do not find any difference, but with more data, we could answer this question.
Thank you for talking about it. It's a fascinating question and a really important question for how we think about justice and what justice actually means. You've all done some amazing research here, but for all of you, it sounds like it was a lot of hard work. Everybody who's tried to do anything like this knows that there's times when you get stuck, you get discouraged, you look at your results and you think, it's not really what I wanted. So what do you do at those times just to keep going?
I try to take a couple of days off and spend some time with my family and friends, because when I take a couple of days off and then I look at the problem again, I see it with new eyes and a solution kind of pops up in a way that I had not thought of before. But of course, for bigger setbacks, I also take the support of my advisors at the university.
I think I talk about my problems a lot, and I'm super lucky because I have a lot of people that can listen to me and give me some ideas about what I should do next steps. And if I really need some time for myself, I would just go and do some sports where I just think about anything else than research.
I am someone who is very fascinated by research, and I like to do it all the time. And even my friends say, you know, stop talking about research many a times. When I am struggling through some phases, I do a couple of things. One is I try to entirely move away from that project and into something entirely different. But at the same time, I also try to take some time off or try to think about new ideas, just some passion projects that would never see the light of day, and think about those. So that's my coping mechanism. I love what I do and I'm excited about it.
There's a common thread through all of this that sometimes it's good to stop what you're doing, if only for a very short time of year.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, all three of you, for talking about that. That was fascinating. And good luck in your future research.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tim.
It was super nice to be here. Thanks, Tim.
Those papers are called Learning Together, Working Together, Coeducation and the Gender Wage Gap in France by Lucy Georgie. Slum Redevelopments and Evictions in a Developing Megacity by Elishuba Philip. And Lawfare in Action, Evidence from Anti-Corruption Trials in Pakistan by Ali Bakhtwar.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, Management Under the Spotlight.